Our last speaker before lunch is Dr. Damon Matthews, who is an associate professor in the Department of Geography, Planning, and Environment at Concordia, where he holds a research chair in science and sustainability. He was a recent member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Committee on Stabilization Targets for Atmospheric Greenhouse Gas Concentrations, and was one of the contributing authors to the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So he's produced over 50 publications on the fundamental and applied science of climate change, which is going to be the focus of his talk today. And he'll be speaking to us today about the implications of climate change for Canadian society.
Thank you, Tony, and for the opportunity to speak today. I'm not going to talk much about Canadian society. Well, a little bit, actually. A lot of people have touched on climate change-related topics today. So this is going to be a very general overview of my perspective of what's going on and what's coming. I'll start with this. This is a picture of global average temperatures this century, so since 2001. And this is actually a very interesting plot for a number of reasons. For one thing, a lot of people have claimed that this is evidence that scientists were actually all wrong and global temperatures are not, in fact, increasing anymore. In fact, there's been no further global warming since 2001. And this was a fairly well-known quote by Nigel Lawson, who's a very prominent climate skeptic in the UK. And he made this statement at a debate in 2009 that was aired across Canada. So, in fact, so far this century, there's been no further recorded global warming at all. Of course, you know, if you take this view of climate change, some people have called this the escalator view of climate change. So here is global warming in the 1990s. And again, there's actually very little you can identify. You can see features. This is Mount Pinatubo that erupted in 1991, a record El Nino event. But beyond those two events, there's actually very little visible trend over this period of time. Similarly, you go back to the 1980s, there's a little bit of an upward trend. You can see that the average has decreased each time. And of course, when you put them all together, you see this very clear pattern of globally average temperatures that have increased, you know, almost a degree over the last 150 years. This, in turn, the statement was prompted by the last IPCC report, and this is a very important statement. I put a definition of unequivocal down at the bottom, just in case it's an unfamiliar term to anyone. It's a very unequivocal word. Temperatures have gone up, and there's no doubt about this. This is a direct measurements of temperature over the last 150 years. Of course, the skeptic community is remarkably resilient. It's probably one of the most resilient ecological communities on the planet. And, of course, in 2009, ClimateGate came around, This statement was cast into doubt. I mean, this is probably the hardest statement to actually cast into doubt of the entire IPCC report. But they tried. And consequently, there was a team of researchers in Berkeley who set out to reassess the climate temperature data. And so they went back and redid an independent analysis of global temperatures, and they found that, yes, indeed, temperatures have gone up. And so no climate change is a reality. And I'm hopeful that most of the world is now accepting this basic fact of the world we're living in. Now, why has temperature gone up? This is it's not a very difficult question to answer, really. But, you know, it's a question of correlations. We don't have a really good experimental Earth to work with. Turns out if you plot global average temperature versus the number of pirates in reverse order, so declining, it's a highly nonlinear scale, I apologize for that. But you get a fairly good correlation. Decreasing pirates gives you increasing numbers of global temperature. So why is it really warm? Well, here's another correlation. Global temperature anomaly versus atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration. It's actually quite remarkable how linear, much more linear than the previous plot, since this is now a linear scale. So why has it warmed? Because carbon dioxide have gone increased. So this is a correlation, the difference being, of course, that there's a very solid scientific theory to explain this particular correlation, which is the theory of global warming, which has about 150-year history. This is not a recent piece of science. Of course, fundamentally, the driver of global warming is CO2 emissions. And, you know, there are other greenhouse gases as well, and I don't mean to diminish the effect, but fundamentally, global warming is a problem of fossil fuel-driven energy production. You know, fossil fuel emissions have, you know, continue to go up despite, you know, a couple of decades now of climate negotiations. Deforestation emissions are potentially going down, which is one positive development that has come about. But currently, we're emitting about 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year, and there's no sign, imminent sign, that this pattern is changing. So this is one of the bewildering aspects of climate change. We have, you know, very good theory. We emit CO2 that increases the strength of the greenhouse effect. You know, we see atmospheric CO2 going up. We see global temperatures going up. We see many impacts, which I'll get to a little bit later, starting to change. You would hope that there would be a human response to this. And when we are part of this system, we are a dynamic part of this system, we have the ability to respond to problems. So what I thought I'd do is just because I'm Canadian, and it's so fun to poke fun at the current political situation in Canada, I've done a qualitative assessment here of the global or the Canadian policy response to global temperature change. And in my view, it looks something like this. So I'll point out some of the salient features of this plot. So, you know, back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, we were one of the leaders in this world. We hosted our Changing Atmosphere conference in Toronto. And, you know, we identified this as a potential global threat to security and a big potential emerging problem. A few years later, this was in 1992, we signed on to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and which is, you know, this is more than 20 years ago now. Around the year 2000, the federal government announced funding for the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science, which has, you know, been a real boon to scientific research on climate change in Canada over the last, you know, 15 years. In 2005, we signed on to the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. So right now we're at about 0.6 degrees of global temperature change. In 2005, we ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Then we had an election. One of the first things that the Conservative government did was to remove funding from the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Sciences. They then introduced what they call the Clean Air Act, which, according to my metric here, gets a score of zero, since it actually has nothing to do with climate change. It's all about air pollution. In 2009, we went to Copenhagen, and I would argue were a complete embarrassment. Shortly after that, a team of climate skeptics was called in to brief the Canadian Senate on, you know, the many complexities of climate change and why we shouldn't be too concerned about it. Shortly after that, Canada withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol formally. Then, as a bit of a bone to throw to keep the scientists busy, they announced a one-time call for federal government funding. This was after they'd already removed the main source of funding. Meanwhile, they're taking credit for slowing emissions growth in Canada while doing everything possible to promote oil sands development in the West. So there's a good news story to this, which I'll get to in a little bit later. But certainly, you know, this is an issue. What does it take to communicate the urgency of this problem to Canadians in particular? And so one thing that I tried to do, which I think was somewhat successful, you know, it turns out that Canadians actually really care about hockey. And there's something I didn't realize growing up on the West Coast in Vancouver. We don't get a lot of outdoor hockey in the winter. I do have a memory of once skating outside in the winter growing up. But, you know, 95% of this country is actually quite passionate about this particular activity. And, you know, it's not rocket science, but warmer winters are getting warmer and, you know, ergo, it gets harder to freeze an outdoor rink in your backyard. And, you know, we made a map of this. This is analysis of weather station data going back 50 years across the country. We tried to identify what were the conditions that you need in order to build a rink in your backyard. You need a couple of consecutive days of very cold temperatures. And you need enough, you know, periodic cold events over the course of the year to keep reflooding the rink. And you can get this information from daily temperature data and try to estimate how the conditions for outdoor skating in Canada have changed over the last 50 years. And it turns out the story is as you might expect, it has not gotten easier to build outdoor rinks. And there's all sorts of stories, anecdotal stories about this as well. But we estimated, this was a historical analysis, we did about, I did a back of the envelope calculation that within, we've seen about a 20 to 30% decrease in the season in the Southwest, ironically centered on Calgary, and that potentially within the next few decades, we're likely to see an end of outdoor skating across most of Southern Canada. And, you know, this is actually important to people. This, you know, probably not the most, certainly not the most dangerous impact of climate change, even for Canadians. But, you know, people like the fact that Wayne Gretzky learned to skate on his father's outdoor rink. And this is actually something that resonates with a lot of people. This is something I learned about this past winter. There's a group in Kitchener-Waterloo who've started a very interesting project. This is a citizen science initiative. So the idea is to try to get Canadians across the country to, and throughout the U.S. as well, to record when rinks are skatable and to actually log onto the site and enter a data point. So this actually might be an interesting data set to look at and to see, you know, to try to nail down some of our predictions about the potential future of outdoor skating in Canada. So what else can we expect? You know, quite a few things. This is the, you know, general progression of this problem. We produce emissions, you know, those emissions go into the atmosphere. Some of them get absorbed by the ocean, which leads to acidification, as Boris was talking about earlier. You know, about half the CO2 we emit actually remains in the atmosphere, leads to temperature change and eventual impacts. And I've, you know, drawn it like this is because, you know, there is a lot of things we don't understand about this picture. And, you know, particularly if you start with a individual emission scenario of the future, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties in the causal chain from emissions of CO2 to some eventual impact. It's very difficult to predict. One thing that's, so ideally, there should be a feedback loop here, which has yet to manifest, I would say, on any kind of global scale. So there are a large range of model projections of the future. And this is sort of a redrawing of the range of projections that came out of the last IPCC report. And this is where I think very important messages sometimes get lost. And if you look at this plot, you can say, you know, there's anywhere from 1 to 6.5 degrees of warming anticipated over the next century. This is all in response to what's called business as usual CO2 emissions. What is clear if you look at this, these are divided into kind of higher emission scenarios and lower emission scenarios. The vast, vast majority of this range has nothing to do with climate uncertainty. It has to do with uncertainty in predicting the course of future human behavior. I mean, this is actually the most difficult problem with respect to predicting future warming. And it's a very interesting paper that analyzed this and broke down the sources of uncertainty amongst the IPCC projections as a function of time. And so what's shown here is the fractional uncertainty, so the fractional contribution to that range that was on the previous plot. Starting on the left-hand side, this is sort of the near future. And so if you think about projections of the next 10 years, and or even the kind of the brief hiatus of warming that has occurred over the last decade, you know, there's a fair amount of that, probably 20, 30% is natural variability. And most people are pointing to that as the reason why temperatures have not increased as much as they otherwise would over the last decade. And then you have different models will give you different results. And this intermodal uncertainty really reflects the uncertainty in scientific understanding of the climate system and how the climate system responds to emissions. As you get further into the future, this green area emerges, which is the human aspect. We don't know, and it's very difficult to predict, how much emissions we're going to produce. But certainly by the time you get to the year 2100, you know, more than 85% of the range of uncertainty in future projections is because we don't know what we're going to do. And, you know, we haven't really decided, to be honest. So future warming depends on, one, how much greenhouse gases we emit. You know, this is really important because it means there's a fair amount of capacity to avoid the very worst impacts of climate change. You know, the future is what we will decide to make it. And that's in this balance of hope and despair, I'd say that's a very hopeful outcome of this way of looking at the picture. Then there's, you know, we don't really understand how sensitive the climate system is, and that will play into whether or not we see, you know, 2 or 3 degrees of warming over the next century in response to the same emission scenario. There's a certain amount of natural variability, which is certainly very important in near-term climate change. It's probably much less important if the further you look into the future. And then there's where in the world you actually live. So I'll talk a little bit about Canadian-specific climate changes that we expect. So global temperatures have gone up by about 0.8 degrees over the last 150 years. Temperatures in Canada have gone up 1.5 degrees over the last, 60 years. So this is about 2.5 times the global average. So, you know, one thing about climate change in Canada is it is happening faster than a lot of other parts of the world. You know, if you look at the amount of temperature change you would expect regionally across the planet for every degree of global temperature. So this is a model projections normalized by the global temperature change. And you look at, for example, most of Canada, you see 1.5 to 2.5 times the global average temperature change. If you get to the very high Arctic, it's maybe more like 3 times the global temperature change. And it's more so in winter. And this is, of course, the driving effect of changes in outdoor skating conditions, is that winter temperatures in Canada have increased more like 2.5 or 3 degrees over the last 50 years. And so seasonally in winter, you know, because of the fact that it's winter and snow is very bright, and this is a very powerful feedback that can amplify changes regionally. Anticipated changes in Canada with winter are, you know, 2 to 4 times the global average is the expectation. Precipitation is also changing. And again, this is a compilation of you know, sort of the current model simulations, again, normalized by global temperature change. So what's shown here is the percentage change in precipitation for every degree that global temperature increases. And if you look at it on an annual average picture, it seems like most of the country is getting wetter. You know, between 5 and 10% increase in total annual precipitation for every degree of global warming. If you look at it seasonally, it's not quite as straightforward. I mean, this is almost always the case. If you look in more detail, it becomes more complicated. I don't know if you can see I guess you can see the slight orange color. So actually, most of southern Canada in the summertime, despite a total increase in precipitation over the course of the year, there's less precipitation in the summer. And so this, you know, this has important implications for agriculture, which will be talked about, I imagine, after lunch. Again, as you move further north, you see increase in precipitation, but, you know, not necessarily snow, and this has important implications as well. In the wintertime, it seems like precipitation is likely to increase everywhere across the country. So what will a 2-degree world look like in Canada? You know, overall, it's going to be more like a 5-degree world for the country, and of course, there'll be some regional variability in that. It'll be less in southern Canada, more in northern Canada. But, you know, 5 degrees is very different from 2 degrees. And this manifests seasonally as well, probably 3 to 4 degrees warmer on average in the summertime, more like 4 to 8 degrees warmer on average in the wintertime. So, you know, 2 degrees is, of course, the target that people are talking about internationally as what would be an acceptable amount of global warming, or maybe a feasible. It's increasingly looking like the political best case scenario. You know, it is going to be a different world in a lot of respects. More warming the further north you go. So precipitation, overall more precipitation. So of course, I've doubled the numbers here. Previously, I was showing precipitation changes per degree. Now for 2 degrees, we're looking at, again, depending on where you are, 5 to 20% increase in total precipitation. Summer, maybe 10% less in the south, 10% more in the north. Winter, on average, more than 20% increase almost everywhere. Again, this is not necessarily snow. Winters are changing faster than anywhere else. So what will this mean? Some of these things have been talked about before. This is a representation of extremes. And what this actually shows, this is, you know, the same climate data that I was showing previously, but what has now been highlighted is the frequency of very, very hot summers. This shows the percentage of summers that are warmer than the current 95th percentile. So what this means is if you think of, you know, the last 20 years, which is probably as far back as most people here can remember, depending on how old you are, I suppose. You know, think about the hottest summer that you remember over that 20 years, there's your 95th percentile. And so 50% in this case means that that 95th percentile, that hottest summer in recent memory, will occur every other year in a 2-degree world. So, you know, 50% or more, depending on where you are, of summers will be warmer than the recent hottest summer that you can remember. And so this is significant. You know, I don't relish hot summers in Montreal. They're not very pleasant. Precipitation extremes. And so, you know, one of the general conclusions that's coming out is that, you know, in areas that precipitation is increasing, so which is most in Canada, that precipitation increase is not necessarily, a nice evenly distributed increase in precipitation. It tends to be a case of more extreme precipitation events that bring more rainfall. This is kind of a blurry figure, but it shows an analysis again of the magnitude of the 20-year precipitation event and how that the strength of that event will change as a function of global warming. And so if you look at the 2-degree world, which is about here, we see a 7 to 20% increase in the strength of the 20-year storm, the amount of rainfall that storm brings. And this, incidentally, also opens the possibility that even if you see a total increase in precipitation driven by more intense individual events, that can go along with an increase in prolonged dry periods as well. And that's something that's important to keep in mind. Sea ice has come up a lot. This is, you know, one of the most dramatic manifestations of climate change that has occurred anywhere in the world, I would say. This is actually this made a lot of news in 2007, which was, a dramatic decrease in sea ice extent. 5 years later, it's not nearly as newsworthy, even though the sea ice extent is actually now lower than it was in 2007. And you can plot, I think Tony showed this same plot, so I won't dwell on this, but, you know, sea ice is decreasing. And so, I didn't have time to actually find the literature as to, you know, when we might expect an ice-free Arctic, so I decided to make my own plot. So if you take this September ice extent data and plot it against global warming, so the global temperature change above pre-industrial for each year, plot it against that year's sea ice, you get a plot that looks something like this. And it's actually not a bad straight line. I didn't do any kind of analysis of whether this was a linear or nonlinear line, but I tend to believe that most things in the climate system are linear, for what that's worth. So let's just pretend that that everything does change linearly. It is the easiest way to make predictions, incidentally. So take this line and just extrapolate it into the future, and you get something like this, which means that by the time we get to 2 degrees, we're going to be very close to, if not at the point where there's no more sea ice in September in the Arctic. And that, you know, that has huge consequences for many different types of human and environmental systems. Permafrost is another issue that's, you know, increasingly getting a lot of attention, partly because it's one of the vanguards of model development. There's only a few climate models in the world that actually include permafrost, representations of permafrost, and consequently there's new results that are coming out. This is one study that was published about a year and a half ago that ran a climate model with a new edition of permafrost, 500 years into the future under four different emission scenarios. And the blue line here is what's called the RCP3 scenario, which is the most aggressive climate mitigation scenario. So this is the scenario that maybe gets you in the vicinity of about 2 degrees warming of a pre-industrial. At that level of warming, we see about a 25% decrease in the aerial extent of permafrost in Canada. This is probably a global figure, but so it'd be Canada and Russia predominantly. So sea level rise. I tend to vacillate between being very concerned about sea level rise and much less concerned about sea level rise than other things. This is the observations of sea level rise over the last 40 years, I guess. There's a gray area here which shows the projections of sea level rise that were made in 1990. And so, you know, observations are following the upper limit of projections, and that's, you know, either an indication that sea level rises are rising faster than indicated, or an indication that climate change is occurring, or that we're emitting CO2 faster than anticipated. Both are probably true. We are driving CO2 emissions up faster than most of the scenarios that that were made in back in 1990. And consequently, you know, many climate changes are following suit, including sea level rise. As to what happens in the future, you know, there's a range of different estimates. And again, it depends a lot on what trajectory of emissions we follow. But most emissions tend to get us between 40 and 100 centimeters of sea level rise by the end of the century. The thing about sea level rise is it doesn't stop with emissions. It's one of the aspects of the climate system that is very, very slow to respond and carries a substantial amount of inertia. And even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases altogether, sea level rise would continue, even if temperature change did not. So, you know, if we look at 2 degrees, let's say we manage to achieve a 2-degree climate and keep temperatures there, that will commit us to something like 1 to 2 meters of sea level rise. It may not happen this century, it may happen a couple of centuries from now, but it will transform coastlines around the world. Now, I mentioned this issue of human response to climate change. This is probably the most interesting question. You know, let's go back to this particular plot that I highly quantitatively presented earlier. So let's extrapolate this and do it in the future for just a minute. We have a federal election coming up. And this is my optimistic view of the world, is that we will have a new government and we will have new policy. So, you know, the thing about human behavior, you know, I said earlier that I tend to believe that the climate system behaves very linearly. We produce more emissions, temperatures goes up more, and there's a lot of things that if you plot them against each other, you see kind of a linear pattern. That's not the case with human societies. And human societies have the capacity to change extremely rapidly and non-linearly. And to me, you know, if you look at the first half of this, you might say that's a reason for despair. I think it is actually a reason for hope, is that at some point we will decide to take this problem seriously and we will implement changes that will, you know, I think very rapidly transform our economy into one that does not produce carbon dioxide. And that's ultimately where we have to go. Of course, there are other ideas that are circulating, and this is, I think, one of the outcomes of despair, is, you know, scientists get extremely frustrated by the slow pace of mitigation and start to come up with all sorts of crazy ideas for how we might actually solve this problem without having to decrease our emissions. And this is only a slight modification to some of the real ideas that are being discussed quite seriously at numerous levels. You know, this issue came up about a year and a half ago. There was a guy in California, what was his name? Russ George, I think. You probably shouldn't quote me on that. Who, you know, has a lot of money and decided to try to generate carbon credits with that money. And this is one of the, you know, unpredictable and dangerous ways that idiotic humans tend to respond to environmental problems. We have the system where we, you know, have people pay money to offset their carbon dioxide emissions, and that opens the door for someone to decide to do something kind of ludicrous to try to sequester carbon in the ocean and create income in the form of carbon credits. And that was, you know, fundamental to the motivation for this particular action. It was, you know, hidden a bit in a guise of trying to provide nutrients for fisheries. But effectively what they did was to dump, you know, a huge amount of iron sulfide, I guess it was, into the ocean off the coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands of Haida Gwaii to try to stimulate productivity, therefore, you know, stimulate the fisheries, and sequester CO2. And this is the idea of iron fertilization. And, you know, scientifically, there's almost no merit to the idea that iron fertilization could sequester CO2 in any kind of long-term capacity. Certainly not without major environmental catastrophes going along with it. At the same time, it's an idea that's out there. And because of this system of carbon credits, there's a potential business opportunity for people to try to take advantage of it in a very unregulated way. And this is, you know, I think geoengineering in general represents one of the most potentially dangerous anthropogenic interferences in the climate system that could occur over the next 20 decades if we don't make the right decisions. So I put this in really, really big letters because, you know, this is the way to solve the climate problem. If we want to stabilize temperatures, so if we want to, so let's say, get to 2 degrees and stay there, we need to be at a point where we are no longer emitting carbon dioxide. And that is a big deal. And so if you think about all the various different impacts of global warming that I've talked about today, we have, you know, environmental changes. They're substantial, and they will continue as long as we continue on the path we're going. Warmer temperatures, this is sort of Canada-specific, wetter winters, drier summers, very hot summers everywhere, more extreme precipitation events, probably no more summer sea ice, loss of permafrost, eventual sea level rise. I forgot to put no more outdoor hockey on this list, but that should probably be there as well. I think the socioeconomic changes that will result from climate change will probably be more significant, at least in the short term, if we want to avoid the most catastrophic potential climate futures. You know, we need to completely transform our energy infrastructure so that we are not emitting carbon dioxide. And, you know, it is, there have been a lot of environmental success stories that you can point to, and various people have pointed to things that we've been able to fix. My view of global warming is that it's different because it hinges intimately on the energy source that we use to do everything. And there's very powerful interests out there who want to maintain that energy source. So it's a big challenge, and it will require every tool that we have in our toolkit in order to make this transformation. But ultimately, this is what needs to happen. And it's going to have a fundamental effect on everyone's lives at some point. Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back a decade, people were, you know, very, you know, the picture was the opposite. And temperatures were sort of going faster than anticipated. I think the best explanation that I've seen is that, you know, it's a question of decadal climate variability. And, you know, if we drew the line at the end of the 20th century, we saw a sort of a period of accelerated warming. If you send that forward a period, you see something going a little bit the other way. There's various people have shown that, you know, with a single model, climate model, you can reproduce, you know, two different climate trajectories over the last decade, one of which, you know, follows observations, one of which doesn't. And if you go forward another decade, they converge and, you know, basically kind of, you know, weave around each other, but eventually go in the same direction. So, I mean, you can explain it entirely from our understanding of natural variability in the system. People have also pointed to other climate drivers like aerosol emissions from increased coal use or volcanic eruptions. I mean, I'm not sure what the best. I'm pretty happy with the natural variability explanation myself. I mean, I don't think you need to evoke.
This article, they were looking at all of these.
Yeah.
And oceans came out as a.
Yeah.
And just a final comment, there's a really wonderful documentary on the Fifth Estate. It's on the web on Lost Georgia. And, it's called Iron Man.
Yeah.
And it really, it's a fascinating social story as much as an environmental story.
Yeah. Yes.
That says a lot. You're talking about a revolution. I'm not disputing the need for that sort of transformation.
Yes, Jay. I could have limited to energy system, actually. That would have been less revolutionary.
I want to know how you feel about the prospects of that necessary action actually happening.
I think it will happen, because if it doesn't happen, I mean, what's the alternative? The alternative is, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees of global temperature. At some point, the planet will become unlivable. And, you know, we could, I suppose, try to colonize Mars. You know, I'm reading a book about Mars colonization right now. That's probably more expensive than transforming our energy system. At some point, I believe that it will happen because, the impacts of climate change are not going to go away, and at some point they'll become so obvious that it would be foolish to do anything else. And I kind of think that'll happen within the next couple of decades. I don't think we're talking about the end of the century. And so, I would not be investing in tar sands development right now. Of course, I'm not an economist, but. I mean, there are some missing technologies. I think that's part of the problem, particularly the capacity to store large amounts of energy for long periods of time. But in general, I agree with you. I actually am optimistic as well. But it's the tone of today's talk, I guess. It sounds like a conversation to have over lunch to me. it's a great question. I mean, you could say that a day like today is trying to do that. I don't have a good answer. All of these environmental problems come from the same fundamental source in my mind. And it's worth talking to each other and trying to identify what those sources are so that we can try to change them.